summer, Roosevelt had hesitated between appointing William Henry Moody and Horace H. Lerton, a Democrat recommended by Taft. He favored the Attorney General, except that Moody came from the same state as Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. Not only that, the antitrust division of the Justice Department was just beginning what promised to be an exciting prosecution of the Standard Oil Company. Any move of Moody would seem either precautionary or defensive. So Lerton had loomed as the next justice until Henry Cabot Lodge, to whom all Democrats were lepers, entered a passionate protest against him. The president, accordingly, remained undecided. He was much more certain of the absolute necessity of getting a new British ambassador to replace Sir Mortimer Durand. During last year's peacemaking efforts, and again during the Algeciras conference, he had been maddened by Durand's disinclination to unbend in private conversation. He interpreted it as stupidity. Actually, the ambassador was a shy but perceptive man, well aware that Roosevelt equated privacy with persuasion. Sir Mortimer also disliked slogging through the thickets of Rock Creek Park, another essential locale for diplomatic dialogue. Without doubt, the British government must recall him. But how, and how soon, could such a delicate matter be arranged? And what chance was there of Cecil Spring Rice being sent instead? Answers would not be forthcoming until the arrival in early October of a possible intermediary, Arthur Lee, M.P., secretly summoned from England. The least urgent, yet most momentous question Roosevelt had to consider was that of his own successor. Mrs. Taft did not know it, but his personal preference always had been for Elihu Root. "I would walk on my hands and knees from the White House to the Capitol to see Root made president, but I know it cannot be done. He couldn't be elected." The Secretary of State was considered by many who knew him to be a great man, something never said of Taft. Intellectually formidable, tireless, brave, unbeatable in any negotiation, Root was hampered by his identity as a corporate lawyer. However honorable, that was simply the wrong thing to be at a time when Roosevelt himself had declared war on laissez-faire. Taft was warm dough to Root's cold iron. He presented no hard edge to the public, or indeed to the president, who imagined that the dough could be permanently imprinted, TR. There were other possible Republican candidates, of course, such as Speaker Cannon and Senator Foraker on the right, and Senator Beveridge on the left. Roosevelt was not averse to flattering any of them in front of reporters, but as long as Chief Justice Fuller stayed alive, he saw his successor in Taft. The Washington Post joked that he did not really need one. "There is but one man who can prevent the Republican Party from nominating Theodore Roosevelt for re-election in 1908, and that man is Theodore Roosevelt himself." Joseph B. Foraker gave early notice of being as much a presidential scourge in the next session of Congress as he had been during the last. In an unctuous telegram received just before Roosevelt's departure from Oyster Bay on 28 September, he wrote, "I fear it may be unwelcome to call your attention to the fact that under our treaty with Cuba, consent is given to the United States, not to the President, to intervene on certain specified grounds." Congressional approval was required before troops could be sent and local authority usurped. "Pardon me for saying this is an awfully serious matter with far-reaching serious consequences." Roosevelt could not deny the treaty, nor the serious view Foraker took of everything, even jokes. He replied with polite restraint, "I am sure you will agree with me that it would not have been wise to summon Congress to consider the situation in Cuba, which was changing from week to week and almost from day to day. You, my dear Senator, are the last man to advocate my playing a part like President Buchanan, or failing to take the responsibility that the President must take if he is fit for his position." So far, he had taken only tentative steps toward intervention and would look to Congress for a permanent policy in December. In the meantime, he reserved his right to intervene directly if necessary. There had been a near total breakdown of government in Havana, with Estrada Palma insisting on full American control, rather than any power sharing with the insurrectos. Privately, Roosevelt seethed at the censorious tone of Foraker's telegram.
The senator had known him since his first participation in a Republican presidential convention at Chicago in 1884. They had been fellow sponsors of a resolution nominating a black man as temporary chairman of the proceedings. Since then, their relations had been formal rather than friendly, although Foraker had supported Roosevelt's nomination for the vice presidency and publicly praised him for entertaining Booker T. Washington. Now, however, Foraker had presumed to question his authority as commander-in-chief. "He is a very powerful and very vindictive man," Roosevelt wrote Lodge, "and he is one of the most unblushing servers and beneficiaries of corporate wealth, within or without office, that I have ever met. It is possible that he has grown to feel so angry over my course, that is, over my having helped rescue the Republican Party, and therefore the country, from the ruin into which, if he had his way..." Lodge was so used to Theodore's eruptions that he did not notice, or choose to notice, incipient signs of executive paranoia. He was more concerned with protecting the president in the event of any open clash with Foraker. After many years of side-by-side service in the Senate, Lodge knew that Fire Alarm Joe could be a dangerous adversary. Foraker was now 60 years old, tall and spare, with steel-gray hair, and more steel, apparently, infusing his spine. He personified the railroads he defended. As a result, he was often caricatured as the ultimate old guard reactionary. If Roosevelt's predominant humor was blood, Foraker's was phlegm. His coldness repelled as much as it intimidated. Only in oratory, at which he excelled, did he live up to his nickname. He was primarily a negative force, resistant to change. In one of the few light moments of a grim summer, the president responded to a request from Attorney General Moody as to the correct orthography of Justice Department press releases. "I can only advise you to follow the example of the younger Mr. Weller, just prior to the moment when he was, in such unseemly fashion, advised by the elder Mr. Weller how to spell his own name, and this to the great scandal of the court." Simplified spelling was now, by presidential edict, compulsory usage in all administration documents. Roosevelt had become a convert of a philological reform movement emanating from Columbia University. An impressive phalanx of academics, with letters trailing after their names, sought to remove as many letters as possible from words that only a typesetter could love. They cited the carefree irregularities of spelling in past centuries, pointing out that the Swan of Avon himself never seemed to know how to spell Shakespeare, and asked why contemporary stylists had become so obsessed with standardization. The answer was, of course, that unpronounced letters caused confusion. Hence, incredibly, 1,690 variants of the noun diarrhea, a word of common significance, if there ever was one. Spelling free of ambiguities, they argued, would do away with the need of standardization, and school children and civil servants could take exams without fear. In its circular number 6 for the summer of 1906, Columbia's Simplified Spelling Board, flush with a gift of $10,000 from Andrew Carnegie, declined to propose any change in the spelling of proper names, especially of surnames, thus ensuring that their donor would not feel obliged to sign any future checks, A-N-D-R-U, K-A-R-N-E-G-I. The president, similarly content not to become R-O-Z-E-V-E-L-T, embraced the board's recommendations with the enthusiasm of a man of letters who had long since objected to the practice of putting a U in honor. It seemed to him that Circular Number 6 and its predecessors justified the adoption of some very moderate and common-sense spelling reforms, which would keep the government in step with the ablest and most practical educators of our time, men such as Thomas R. Lounsbury, professor of English at Yale University. In a letter to the public printer of the United States, Roosevelt ordered simplified spelling of some 300 frequently used words. Such changes, he argued, were but a very slight extension of the unconscious movement which has made agricultural implement makers and farmers write PLOW instead of PLOUGH, just as all people who speak English now write BATSET, DIM, SUM, and FISH, instead of the Elizabethan BATTE, SETTE, DIMME, SUMME, and FYSSHE. There could be little protest against these examples, certainly not by menu writers in Chinatown, where dim sum was already approved usage. But Roosevelt's appended list of new spellings caused a sensation in bureaucratic Washington. Addressed, ADDRESST, blushed, BLUSHT, comprise, COMPRIZE, depressed, DEPREST, aegis, EGIS, faggot, FAGOT, gazelle, GAZEL, kissed, KIST, partisan, PARTIZAN, phoenix, PHENIX, pure, PUR, ripped, RIPT, snapped, SNAPT, through, THRU, vexed, VEXT, winked, WINKT. Soon the nation's newspapers were vying with one another to coin new, sarcastic simplifications, until Harper's Weekly complained, "This is too, T-U, much, M-U-T-C-H." Members of Congress and the Supreme Court announced their absolute unwillingness to go along. Roosevelt seemed to sense defeat, even as he insisted that he would continue to use the new styles himself. He told the public printer that none of his changes should be considered permanent. If they do not ultimately meet with popular approval, they will be dropped, D-R-O-P-T, and that is all there is about it. On 29 September, President Estrada Palma and his entire cabinet resigned, leaving Taft with no alternative under the Platt Amendment but to issue a declaration of intervention by the United States. He established himself as the temporary executive of a Cuban administration, conforming as far as may be to the Constitution of Cuba, and operating under the Cuban flag. Roosevelt had insisted on that last touch. He told Taft that the role of the United States must simply be to ensure that Cuba stayed solvent and stable until she could once again govern herself. To that end, American troops would guard the island's treasury and maintain order in her towns. A simultaneous agreement with the liberals guaranteed that all insurrectionary activities would cease, pending free and legal elections. In his last official act, before returning to Washington from Oyster Bay, Roosevelt sent Taft 6,000 additional troops. "I congratulate you most heartily upon the admirable way you've handled the whole matter," he cabled, adding that he had instructed the State Department to continue Cuban foreign relations as if no change had occurred. It was crucial that all islanders understood that he had intervened only because the government had collapsed. "I am most anxious that there should be no bloodshed between Americans and Cubans." Back in the White House on 1 October, he chafed at not having Taft at hand to help him decide finally between Moody and Lurton for the Supreme Court. He did not trust his own judgment on matters of constitutional import, and in this case could hardly ask the Attorney General for an opinion. Even more critical was the ugly matter of Brownsville. Ideally, Taft should be in charge of it as Secretary of War, but until a provisional governor could be installed, somewhere around mid-month, Roosevelt would have to supervise the Army's ongoing investigation. It was fraught with political risk. Color had become an issue in the congressional campaign after the recent outbreak in Atlanta of some of the worst race violence on record. 20 black men had been killed and hundreds wounded at the hands of a mob crazed by reports of an unusual number of Negro assaults on white women. Roosevelt remained silent on the massacre. He did not even mention race relations in his platform address of the season, a somewhat repetitive-sounding denunciation of corporate greed delivered on 4 October in Harrisburg. Only those with ears attuned to the clang of Rooseveltian clichés detected a new overtone of impatience with executive restraints. He paid homage, for the gratification of his audience, to the Pennsylvanian jurist and founding father James Wilson, 1742 to 1798, and cited Wilson's belief that one uniform and comprehensive system of government and laws arose in response to frequently conflicting decisions of state and federal judges. That super-jurisdiction was, in effect, the will of the sovereign people, who, in 1906, were determined to assert their sovereignty over the great corporations of the day. To Henry Cabot Lodge, knowing Roosevelt's tendency to use the word sovereign as if it were a personal pronoun, such statements sounded more like Nietzsche than Wilson. But the senator worried only that his old friend was bearing down too hard on businessmen as opposed to radical agitators. Had Lodge a deeper knowledge of Wilson's philosophy, he might have come across a ruminative passage that was practically pure Theodore. If I am asked, how do you know that you ought to do that, of which your conscience enjoins the performance, I can only say, I feel that such is my duty. Here investigation must stop. Reasoning can go no farther. Propelled by just such a sense of moral certainty, hearing answers rather than questions, and inviting no argument, Roosevelt decided it was time to bring the Brownsville affair to a conclusion. He ordered his new Inspector General, Ernest A. Garlington, to proceed to Oklahoma and Texas and interview the quarantined members of the 25th Infantry personally. If the guilty parties cannot be discovered, the President approves the recommendation, by Major Bloxam, that the whole three companies implicated in this atrocious outrage should be dismissed and the men forever debarred from reenlisting in the Army or Navy of the United States. While awaiting General Garlington's report, the President played host to Arthur Lee. His old friend arrived from England on 12 October, rather mystified at having been summoned across the Atlantic without explanation. Roosevelt, who made no small talk, immediately broached the subject. "I have had to finally abandon any attempts to do confidential business through the British ambassador, and must do it through someone else." As a member of the government Sir Mortimer Durand represented, Lee was at once put into a delicate diplomatic position. Roosevelt made him understand that something more important than protocol was at stake. The United States and Great Britain ought to be in specially intimate relations, but had reached a virtual standstill because of Durand's imprisonment in his own culture. "He doesn't begin to understand us." At present, fortunately, the international situation was quiet, and no difficult negotiations loomed between Washington and London. "I say this, however," Roosevelt went on, "and cannot say it too emphatically, that if any difficult question does arise, your government will have to send over, specially, someone with whom we can work, to deal with it. This is not merely my view, but that of Root and also of Taft, who will probably be the next president." Lee stayed at the White House for several days, during which time he was permitted to read the private correspondence Roosevelt had had with other ambassadors during the Portsmouth and Algeciras conferences. "I cannot help but deplore the gradual waning of British prestige and popularity over here during the last 3 years," the President said, knowing that his words would be repeated throughout Whitehall, "and the eclipse of the British embassy by the French and German missions, both of which are exceptionally well filled." Edith Roosevelt contributed her own quiet propaganda over dinner. "You remember, of course, that in your time here, and until Sir Michael Herbert died, it was never spoken of in Washington except as the embassy." Lee remembered well, and with nostalgia. In 1899, he had been military attaché to Sir Julian Pauncefoot and engaged to marry an American heiress. It was largely to Ruth Lee's fortune that he owed his current comfortable place in British society. Now Mrs. Roosevelt seemed to be suggesting that the pair of them could restore 1300 Connecticut Avenue to the center of Washington's Omond. "Hardly any of the right kind of people go there," Edith pursued. "The Durands do practically nothing in the way of entertaining, and that little so poorly that people do not care to go." Lee left the White House with an official note from Roosevelt, practically appointing him to the British Foreign Service. He did not know that a letter recalling Sir Mortimer was already on its way. Sir Edward Grey had heard so many presidential complaints about Durand from Henry White that a more cerebral ambassador was being looked for. This did not augur well for Lee, who in any case sat on the wrong side of the House of Commons. Sir Mortimer was thunderstruck when Grey's letter arrived on 21 October. Twice that night he had come down to reopen his dispatch box, to assure myself that I had not dreamt the whole thing. He had not. His diplomatic career was over. Edith Roosevelt had chosen the right qualifier to describe the way the Durands entertained. Sir Mortimer was not a wealthy man, and for 2 years had spent dollars as if they were shillings, just to fulfill his mission. He had given up polo, books, hunting, and traded in his life insurance policy. Even so, he was penniless. "I must try to take it like a gentleman," he wrote in his diary. By now, Taft was back in Washington, having installed Charles E. Magoon as provisional governor of Cuba. The crisis that had so upset Roosevelt seemed to have been resolved without force, and with the happy acquiescence of most islanders. No date was yet set for Cuba Libre Segundo, but Taft and Magoon both understood that it had to occur before the president left office. Senator Foraker was forced to acknowledge that the administration had behaved honorably toward a sister republic. Perhaps now, he suggested in a campaign speech, the administration would find time to address some problems closer to home, such as that of race relations. "It is important to protect Cubans in Cuba, but it is even more important to protect Americans in America." Ignoring him, Roosevelt commandeered Taft and Root for 5 days of tense consultations about the Supreme Court matter. 3 sitting justices and 4 senators helped him decide that William H. Moody would be his 3rd appointee to the bench. The official announcement was delayed, for propriety, until after the elections, but Moody's name was leaked on 24 October, to the great satisfaction of voters from Massachusetts. General Garlington's Brownsville report reached the War Department around the same time. It was remarkable for a lack of evidence so total as to inculpate him for word-spinning. He stated that during exhaustive interviews with the main suspects in San Antonio, he had encountered nothing but a wooden, stolid look, as each soldier in turn positively denied any knowledge of the affair. This, to an investigating officer brought up in Greenville, South Carolina, could mean only the opposite. He had called them all back in groups and made sure they understood the president's ultimatum. If no man confessed or informed, all would be adjudged guilty. They remained silent. Garlington had then proceeded to Fort Reno and interviewed the troops held in quarantine. Again he was frustrated by the conspiratorial caginess he took to be typical of black men. The secretive nature of the race, where crimes to members of their color are charged, is well known. He concluded that the firing into the houses of the citizens of Brownsville was done by enlisted men of the 25th Infantry, and recommended that every man in the battalion be held responsible for the crimes of the few. As the president had stipulated, they should be dishonorably discharged. On 30 October, Roosevelt summoned Booker T. Washington to the White House in a clear indication that he was worried about how Negro voters might react. Election Day was just 1 week away, and the political situation nationwide was volatile. The Democratic Party had recovered from its debacle under Alton B. Parker 2 years before, and, as Senator Foraker gloomily observed, stood to gain from progressive, conservative infighting among Republicans. Race and labor were key issues, with the industrial workers of the world fanning radical discontent among Western miners, and Southern whites wildly agitated by the Atlanta riots. In Tennessee, rumors circulated of Negro companies drilling by night. William Randolph Hearst was showing alarming strength as the Democratic nominee for governor of New York against Roosevelt's personal candidate, Charles Evans Hughes, a coldly brilliant Republican lawyer. Washington listened with misgivings as the president told him that he was about to dismiss 167 Negro soldiers, without honor and without trial. He had just been in Atlanta and sensed that Roosevelt was making a terrible mistake. American blacks would have trouble understanding why our friend, as Washington always called him, should rush to judgment at such a time without giving a single man of the 25th Infantry a chance to testify in court. Even more distressing was the likelihood that redneck racists everywhere would applaud Roosevelt's willingness to act on what passed for evidence in lynch country. Unsubstantiated charges of rape, instant identifications of black men last seen in darkness, the wooden, stolid look of Negro terror, and a few dozen shell casings ejected from clean rifles. Washington's distress grew after leaving the executive office. On 3 November, he wrote begging Roosevelt not to do anything precipitous about Brownsville until they could meet again. "There is some information which I must put before you take final action." But his letter arrived at the wrong psychological moment. Roosevelt's blood was up after 2 days of hunting wild turkey at Pine Knot. It was election eve, and he was about to leave for New York, where Elihu Root, speaking on White House authority, had just come within one syllable of saying that the president held William Randolph Hearst responsible for the death of William McKinley. Root's statement had pulverized the Democratic campaign, not to mention Hearst's chances of running for president in 1908. Roosevelt could not wait to get to a voting booth to add to the rout. He had no interest in belaboring Brownsville any further. "You cannot have any information to give me privately to which I could pay heed, my dear Mr. Washington," he wrote, "because the information on which I act came out of the investigation itself." With that, he left for Oyster Bay by overnight train. His discharge order, dated 5 November 1906, was not released for another 36 hours, until after Republicans had gone to the polls to elect Hughes governor of New York and re-elect Congressman Nicholas Longworth in Cincinnati. Had just half of Nick's 3,000-odd black constituents voted against him, he would have lost his seat, and possibly his wife. Across the nation, Roosevelt's popularity helped contain the Democratic surge. The GOP lost 28 seats in the House, but retained its working majority, and gained 4 seats in the Senate. It won Massachusetts and Ohio, and Roosevelt was pleased to see Frank R. Gooding, Idaho's anti-radical governor, re-elected in a rebuff to the Western Federation of Miners. Representative James Wadsworth was punished for opposing last spring's meat bill and sent back to the farm to inspect his own beeves at leisure. Sales of The Jungle notwithstanding, socialist candidates suffered everywhere. "Well, we have certainly smitten Ammon hip and thigh," Roosevelt wrote to Alice. Meanwhile, blacks, fresh from the polls, pondered his special order number 266, as transmitted by the War Department. "By direction of the President, the following named enlisted men in companies B, C, and D, 25th Infantry, certain members of which organizations participated in the riotous disturbance which occurred in Brownsville, Texas, on the night of August 13, 1906, will be discharged without honor from the Army by their respective commanding officers, and forever debarred from re-enlisting in the Army or Navy of the United States, as well as from employment in any civil capacity under the government." There followed 167 names, including that of First Sergeant Mingo Sanders, who had fought in Cuba in 98 and remembered dividing rations of hardtack and bacon with Colonel Roosevelt after the Battle of Las Guasimas. Corporals Solomon P. O'Neill, Temple Thornton, and Winter Washington. Cooks Leroy Horn and Solomon Johnson. Musicians Joseph Jones, Henry Odom, and Hoyt Robinson. And privates Battier Bailey, Carolina de Saussure, Ernest English, Thomas Jefferson, Willie Lemons, Joseph Shanks, John Slow, Zachariah Sparks, William Van Hook, and Dorsey Willis. Booker T. Washington was not surprised by the swiftness and unanimity of black reaction. For the last 5 years, he sadly noted, Theodore Roosevelt had been the idol of America's 10 million Negroes. Now, within days,
I might almost say hours. The president had become a pariah. Telegrams of protest began to flow into the White House, not all from blacks. Roosevelt replied to one with an arrogance of tone and language that increasingly reflected his attitude to criticism. The order in question will in no way be rescinded or modified. The action was precisely such as I would have taken had the soldiers guilty of the misconduct been white men. I can only say that I feel the most profound indifference to any possible attack which can be made on me in this matter. On 16 November, the first dishonorable discharge papers were served on men of the 25th Infantry. Roosevelt's name was mentioned at a black convention that day, and was received in complete silence. But by then the president was in Panama, in the depths of the Culebra Cut, watching the dirt fly. He had seen Culebra looming over the Louisiana's white bow before he saw anything else of the isthmus. Too low to be a cordillera, too high for any rock splitters in the world, save those of the United States, it was already carved half open. Imaginations less vivid than his would have no difficulty picturing the day, perhaps no more than 6 or 7 years off, when the continental spine would be snapped, and North and South America, paradoxically, brought closer together by a mutual highway of water. A new age of wealth and Pacific connections was coming to all those invisible Latin republics lying off to his left, while El Coloseo del Norte would be able to speed battleships as big as this one, and bigger, through her own secure conduit. In the meantime, there was the vital question of yams. Roosevelt heard about them in the cockpit of a Bucyrus steam shovel, which attracted him so irresistibly that he had stopped his open-sided train and clambered aboard, careless of mud. Edith watched him seek out the driver's seat, her expression veiled by what looked like a small meat safe of mosquito netting. While a cameraman snapped away, the president asked about workforce morale. The shovel operator said it was not good among the 19,000 black laborers, mostly British West Indians, who did most of the digging in the cut. No number of monster machines could compensate for the loss of these men, should discontent send them home. American Negroes were deemed not strong enough to work in tropical heat. Food was part of the problem. Panama yams, sold in the labor camp commissary, did not compare to those of Jamaica. There appeared to be a direct correlation between yam quality and productivity along the line, perilous to the future of world commerce. Roosevelt proceeded through the cut in rain so torrential that the Mount Hope Reservoir, not yet ready for use, began to fill up. He stopped at the sump to observe the copulatory heavings and thrustings of an excavation plow, but food remained on his mind, and he kept asking workers about their diet. At Rio Grande, he heard that the government-issue vegetables tasted worse and cost more than those in private stores. Seizing one complainer, he escorted him into the camp commissary. The clerk remained stoic at the sight of a burly president in a white suit and mud-spattered canvas leggings. "Let me see your yams," Roosevelt said, firing off monosyllables like a repeater rifle. "Here is a yam that does not look right to me. This man says you sell him rotten yams." "Yes, sir, and it's not surprising," the clerk replied. "Yams may go bad in a few hours in this climate." He explained that yams were susceptible to spoilage in great heat. In Panama, as elsewhere around the globe, the doctrine of caveat emptor applied. If a customer found rot specks on any purchased yam, he could always bring it back for exchange. Roosevelt appealed to his informant. "Mr. President," came the reply in lilting Caribbean English, "I does not incline to demean my personal dignity by comporting myself with such bally, humiliating condescension." Taking the hint, Roosevelt got back on his train and headed south on the tracks that Colonel Shaler, 3 years before, had closed to the Colombian Tiradores. He called halts so often en route that the fingers of Theodore P. Shantz, president of the Canal Zone's governing commission, drummed with nervousness. By the time he got to Panama City, in a cacophony of steam whistles, Roosevelt had been touring sites and asking questions for almost 10 hours. His cotton blouse was dark with sweat, and his leggings encrusted enough to make him waddle, but he exulted in everything he had seen and heard. Much of it had been squalid, rather than magnificent. The black labor force was so disease-prone that Shantz was thinking of bringing in Chinese coolies. Perhaps sanitary and nutritional reforms would help. Certainly, flush toilets would. Roosevelt felt that government mess facilities, run by married couples from Jamaica or Barbados, might eradicate dirt-floor cooking sheds. And if West Indians would only stop sleeping in the same wet clothes they worked in, their alarming mortality rate, 85 pneumonia deaths in the last month alone, would surely improve. The president, as H.G. Wells had noticed, was incapable of seeing negatives, except in positive translation. The sheer extremity of Panama's challenges, meteorological, technological, geological, psychological, was wine to his head. He could not wait, the next morning, to get back to the Culebra Cut, even though rain was falling heavier than ever, and a landslide near Paraiso diverted his train. Dynamiters blew the top off a bluff for him. Steam shovels ate rock. A choir of Zonian schoolchildren sang the Star-Spangled Banner. John Stevens, chief engineer, stood him on a hilltop, map in hand, and verbally built a new town in minutes. All around them, flash cascadas ran down the slopes, and villages lay half-drowned, as if the canal was already rising. Descending to the floor of Gatun Dam, Roosevelt was struck by the thought that in a few years' time, ocean liners would be floating in water 100 feet above his head. "Stevens and his men," the president wrote Kermit a few days later, "are changing the face of the continent and doing the greatest engineering feat of the ages, and the effect of their work will be felt while our civilization lasts." He was returning home on the Louisiana with two other war vessels in convoy, able for the first time to visualize the true enormity of his achievement in Panama. What he had made possible, Stevens was making real. The chief engineer was just his kind of person, a big fellow, a man of daring and good sense and burly power. Kermit, who was expected to keep this letter for posterity, may have recognized the unconscious, if slightly enlarged, self-portrait his father always painted when he described someone he admired. Stevens was actually 5 years older and an inch taller than the president, but the key words, perhaps, were daring and burly power. A newer element in Roosevelt's letter was what the Kaiser might call the Erdenton, or Earth Note. Its implication, again unconscious, seemed to be that Stevens and his technicians, so hardy, so efficient, so energetic, were not the only Americans changing the face of the world in 1906. Theodore Roosevelt, too, wanted to leave his impress on civilization. That made the cable that awaited him at Ponce, Puerto Rico, on 21 November, all the more annoying. New York Republican Club and many others appealing for a suspension of the order discharging colored troops until your return. Much agitation on the subject, and it may be well to convince people of fairness of hearing by granting rehearing. Taft. If press reports were to be believed, Taft had actually granted such a suspension, pending the president's return. Roosevelt was quick to countermand it. "Discharge is not to be suspended," he wired back, "unless there are new facts of such importance as to warrant your cabling me. I care nothing whatever for the yelling of either the politicians or the sentimentalists." While he continued his voyage north, bypassing Cuba, army processors obediently reduced the ranks of the 25th Infantry to zero. The last Brownsville raider surrendered his uniform on 26 November, a few hours before Roosevelt got back to Washington. By now, a burgeoning editorial consensus had begun to express dismay at the insubstantiality of the War Department's reports on Brownsville. The New York Times noted that there was not a particle of evidence in any of them to justify dismissal without honor. Read in sequence, the documents showed that every authority concerned, from Major Penrose to the president, had proceeded on an assumption of guilt and challenged the soldiers to prove their own innocence.
This case was made most forcefully by the Constitution League, a new progressive multiracial alliance dedicated to fighting discrimination and disfranchisement. Financed, for the most part, by the sort of rich white goo-goos Roosevelt despised, men lacking in burly power, it found in Brownsville the cause it was looking for and began an independent investigation. At the end of November, Gilchrist Stewart, a black attorney for the League, came to Washington to present Roosevelt with a 4-page memorandum of reasons why the discharged soldiers might be innocent. William Loeb, forewarned, made the president unavailable, so Stewart presented the memorandum to Joseph B. Foraker instead. The senator, too, was looking for a cause, now that railroad rate regulation was a fait accompli, and Cuba no longer a scare. He had aspirations to succeed Roosevelt in the White House, if he could find some way of discrediting Taft as presidential heir apparent, for that matter, discrediting Roosevelt, too. He was sure that he was good-looking and eloquent enough and popular enough in corporate boardrooms to be nominated in 1908. Brownsville offered him both the means and end of this grand plan. Beyond ambition, and in contrast to his otherwise negative disposition, Foraker had a passion for racial justice. As a young Union soldier, he had wanted the Civil War to go on until slavery is abolished and every colored man is made a citizen and is given precisely the same civil and political rights that the white man has. Political opponents accused him of caring only for the Negro voters of Ohio. He certainly never professed any particular fondness for blacks in general. Senator Foraker merely felt the same about the Constitution in 1906 as Private Foraker had felt in 1862. He was so electrified by the Constitution League's memorandum that he began to amass his own archive of Brownsvilleana at home, muttering as he studied letters and clippings. Julia Foraker recognized the signs. Her husband was planning a resolution on the subject as soon as Congress reconvened. Roosevelt's 6th annual message, delivered on 4 December, was notable for the fervor of its condemnation of race hatred, in particular the bestial nature of lynch law. "The members of the white race should understand that every lynching represents, by just so much, a loosening of the bands of civilization, that the spirit of lynching inevitably throws into prominence in the community all the foul and evil creatures who dwell therein. No man can take part in the torture of a human being without having his own moral nature permanently lowered. Every lynching means just so much moral deterioration in all the children who have any knowledge of it, and therefore just so much additional trouble for the next generation of Americans." Unfortunately for the president, these fine words had a hollow ring in the upper chamber, where Senator Foraker had already introduced his Brownsville resolution. It directed the Secretary of War to supply the Senate with every official document pertaining to the case, along with the service records of every black man dismissed. The resolution was approved, giving Taft no choice but to comply. Resentfully, he complained to reporters that the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army was empowered to dismiss soldiers without honor. Foraker's response, measured and scholarly, made Taft sound like a whiner. Roosevelt indeed had that privilege, but the Articles of War did not permit him to inflict it as a punishment, as though it had been in pursuance of the sentence of a court-martial. Taft, as a former judge, must surely remember that "no man can be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of the law." Roosevelt remained silent. He closeted himself with the original Brownsville report of Major Bloxam, rereading it carefully. Its findings did not alter his conviction as to the guilt of the men, but after studying another view of the case by a retired Union Army general, he betrayed the first trace of regret over the hastiness of his action. He wrote Taft a confidential note, saying he was now uncertain whether or not the officers of the 3 colored companies are or are not blamable, and asking for a thorough, thoro, investigation to clarify his thinking.
All in all, this was not a propitious moment for Theodore Roosevelt to be officially informed that he had just won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in ending the Russo-Japanese War. "I am profoundly moved and touched," he cabled the chairman of the Nobel Committee. "What I did, I was able to accomplish only as the representative of the nation of which, for the time being, I am president." He added that, upon reflection, he had decided to donate the prize money, almost $37,000, to a foundation to establish at Washington a permanent industrial peace committee. To Kermit, he explained that after consultation with Edith, he could not accept as a personal gift a sum of money earned as a public figure. "But I hated to come to the decision, because I very much wished, W-I-S-H-T, for the extra money to leave to all you children." Sir Mortimer Durand's last public view of Roosevelt occurred at a gridiron dinner on 8 December. He thought that the president's laughter seemed strained, and noticed a flash of anger when somebody joked about a possible third term. Sir Mortimer Durand's last public view of Roosevelt occurred at a gridiron dinner on 8 December. He thought that the president's laughter seemed strained, and noticed a flash of anger when somebody joked about a possible third term. "Now don't let us have any damn nonsense," Roosevelt said, raising a hand to quiet the crowd. "When I made that decision on the night of my election, I knew what I was about." He continued with his speech, his voice constantly breaking into falsetto. Durand studied the bulldog profile, the bared teeth, and strange neck scar. "It is not beautiful, but there is nevertheless an undeniable strength about it. It is a vehement, rather vulgar strength, and some allowance must be made for the divinity that doth hedge a king. But there is strength of a kind. He is not quite a gentleman, but he is fitted for success in the world." A good motto for him, Durand thought, would be "Rem facias rem, si possis recte, si non quocunque modo rem." The thing, get the thing, fairly if possible, if not, then however it can be gotten. Roosevelt believed himself to be righteous, and his nature was to believe things with such passion that he took no prisoners when contradicted. "I regard him as a man who might at any time be extremely dangerous, for neither his temper nor his honesty can be trusted." As if in proof, Roosevelt the Righteous attacked on 19 December with a special message to the Senate, totally upholding the Bloxham Report. Scores of eyewitnesses in Brownsville had established beyond any doubt that lawless and murderous Negro soldiers had leaped over the walls from the barracks and hurried through the town, blasting away with their guns at whomever they saw moving. The testimony of those who watched in horror was conclusive, and there was the corroborative evidence of army issue, shattered bullets, shells, and clips. As to the shared guilt of all the men he had discharged, there was no question of their complicity in shielding those who took part in the original conspiracy of murder. Roosevelt searched, rather too hastily, for words to communicate the dastardliness of their crime. "A blacker," he wrote, "never stained the annals of our army." He used his strongest language in repudiating Foraker's assertion that the dishonorable discharge was not a legitimate punishment. The only thing wrong with it was that it was utterly inadequate in this case. The punishment meet for mutineers and murderers, such as those guilty of the Brownsville assault, is death, and a punishment only less severe ought to be meted out to those who have aided and abetted mutiny and murder and treason by refusing to help in their detection. Foraker responded on the floor of the Senate with a speech that limited itself to facts. He said that only 8, not scores, of witnesses claimed to have seen Negro soldiers rioting. He demonstrated the invalidity of every precedent and legal argument Roosevelt and Taft had cited for the discharges. He looked for hard evidence of a conspiracy, found none, and noted that General Garlington had had no better luck. Few listening could doubt that a political war was being declared.
it would probably last as long as the president continued to bluster and the Senate continued to probe. Strife between executive and legislative, impetuosity and due process. Fortunately, Christmas was coming and New Year's Day, with its traditional courtesies, so there was time for both sides to weigh the costs of battle. "When you turn those niggers out of the army at Brownsville," Owen Wister asked Roosevelt, "why didn't you order a court of inquiry for the commissioned officers?" The two old friends were out walking together along the shore of the Potomac. "Because I listened to the War Department, and I shouldn't," Roosevelt replied. He paused. "Of course, I can't know all about everything." Defensively, he launched into a long disquisition of the fickleness of financial advisers. Wister heard him out. "And so the best you can do is to stop, look, and listen, and then jump." "Yes, and then jump, and hope I've jumped right." Chapter 28. The Clouds That Are Gathering. "We've been staggering under such a load of material wealth that if we can't dump some of it, I don't know what'll happen to us. We are so rich that if we were any richer, we'd be broke." The new year of 1907 found Theodore Roosevelt at the peak of his presidency. With Cuba peaceful and the Senate irresolute for the moment on Brownsville, he could luxuriate in his Nobel Prize and congratulate himself on the fact that if he so much as winked, a popular majority would form to re-elect him in 1908. He was still only 48 years old. America was unprecedentedly prosperous. The national product had become so gross that railroads were hard put to supply enough cars and banks enough cash to move it. As a result, prices were rising, but so were wages. All this good economic news redounded to the credit of the man in the White House. Attendees at his annual New Year's reception observed only one note of grimness in the smiles and handshakes he exchanged with more than 8,000 visitors. It occurred when he greeted Senator Foraker. The following morning, Roosevelt had an hour-long legislative conference with Speaker Cannon and Congressman Longworth. He did not indicate to the press, if indeed he even realized, that exactly one quarter of a century had passed since he first attended such a conference in Albany as the freshman assemblyman from the Silk Stocking District. Then, as ever since, his obsession had been to find and hold the center of power. In 1882, he had watched a small group of Tammany mavericks parlay 8 votes out of 128 into an operating advantage that had effectively immobilized the state government for more than 3 weeks. Roosevelt had never forgotten his early lesson in the application of physics to political process. A mass of opinion on one side was quantifiably irrelevant if balanced by an equal and contrary mass on the other. The same went for any number of masses, large or small, as long as they balanced circularly. Only the slightest pressure, applied by whoever stayed in medias res, was necessary to tilt the opposites to and fro, or, for that matter, hold them still. That was power, operating freedom, not force. He saw that his legislative balancing act now was going to be especially delicate through 4 March, when the 59th Congress would end. With a much more Democratic Congress due in December, he was going to be losing many old allies, most seriously Senator Spooner, and gaining, if not enemies, at best an equal number of newcomers, more likely to cultivate his heir apparent than himself. Those Republicans re-elected would, by the same token, not have to worry any more about contradicting an enormously popular president. Even the representatives among them now knew that they would see out his second term. To maintain his centricity, therefore, he was going to have to be less confrontational and more accommodating as his power slowly waned. When decisive action was necessary, he could always resort to a privilege he understood better than any president before him, that of the executive order. On 14 January, Roosevelt moved to quell a fierce Senate debate over whether he had exceeded his authority in dismissing the Brownsville soldiers. He sent Congress another special message on the subject, much less aggressive than his first. Although he still insisted that he had acted correctly, he allowed for the first time that he was prepared to readmit any dischargee who, shows to my satisfaction that he is clear of guilt, or of shielding the guilty. This was not of much comfort to those who believed that the burden of proof should lie on the other side, but it persuaded a majority of the Senate that the President had not broken any law. Foraker, undeterred, pressed for and won a full investigation. Next, the President tried to counter this belief in Wall Street that I am a wild-eyed revolutionist. He had always jumped at chances to show plutocrats that he had no objection to the formation of trusts of any size, as long as they consented to scrutiny by the Bureau of Corporations. Such an opportunity presented itself when George W. Perkins arranged for Judge Elbert H. Gary, chairman of U.S. Steel, and Cyrus H. McCormick, president of International Harvester, to meet discreetly with Roosevelt's incoming and outgoing corporations commissioners, Herbert Knox Smith and James Garfield. The encounter took place in a New York hotel on 18 January. Perkins, who was fluent in both federal and boardroom English, acted as interpreter. Judge Gary praised the work of the Bureau of Corporations under Garfield and said that President Roosevelt's overall supervision had helped make it a bastion of private rights. He added that he hoped the agency would be as willing to cooperate with International Harvester in the future as it had been with his own company in the past. This was a discreet allusion to a deal that Gary had concluded with Roosevelt and Garfield more than a year before. Faced with a Bureau investigation of U.S. Steel, he had undertaken to open up the giant trust's books, on condition that only the President could decide whether there was anything there worth prosecuting. The agreement had worked well enough to avoid any antitrust action by the Justice Department. Now Congress was calling for a Bureau probe into allegations that McCormick's company was monopolistic. Perkins and Gary asked, as board members, if the President would extend International Harvester the same kind of most favored trust status. Garfield was quite sure that Roosevelt would, and so was Roosevelt when he heard. Gentlemen's agreements were an accepted part of his code of behavior, as was the discretion they entailed. All Americans needed to know, in this case, was that he knew all about a giant trust that already controlled 85% of the national reaper and harvester market. If members of the Gridiron Club, welcoming Roosevelt to their annual dinner on 26 January, wondered how he could possibly top his previous performances before them, they soon found out. He arrived at the new Willard Hotel looking unusually grim, and the club president, Samuel G. Blythe, saw that entertaining him was not going to be easy. When Roosevelt took his seat next to Blythe, he saw that by chance, or more likely design, Joseph Foraker had been placed in front of them at a table perpendicular to the main table. He thus could look forward to several hours of studying the senator's haughty profile, while Foraker did not have to look at him. Oysters were served, then clear green turtle soup. Between spoonfuls, the president leafed through a souvenir booklet of caricatures of prominent guests. Each sketch was accompanied by jokey captions. One beneath Foraker's portrait arrested his attention. "All coons look alike to me." Blythe saw the presidential jaw tighten and got an impression of slowly rising fury. Roosevelt waited for the planked shad to be served, then leaned over and said, "I would like to speak now, if it can be arranged." Service was halted, and Blythe rose to announce the President of the United States. Diners laid down their forks in surprise. Roosevelt began, cordially enough, with compliments to his hosts, then swung on a millionaire's row of financiers and lectured them on corporate control. His manner became peremptory. Men of wealth, he said, were going to have to learn to live with the reforms undertaken by his administration. J. Pierpont Morgan listened, glowering, three places to his left. The only alternative was a takeover of Wall Street by the mob, the mob, the mob. Then, picking up his souvenir program, Roosevelt read aloud, "J. B. Foraker says he, "all coons look alike to me." He threw the booklet down in disgust. "Well, all coons do not look alike to me." These words were delivered in a near shout. Roosevelt stared straight into Foraker's eyes and launched into a passionate rationale for his Brownsville action. The Shad grew cold as he attacked Foraker for questioning an executive decision by the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army. Senate debate on the subject was academic because he had all power vested in himself in such matters. And all meant what it said. Nobody else had any power of review of the discharges. Diners from the back of the room stood up and crowded the aisles. Foraker sat fidgeting. After half an hour, Roosevelt ended with a few conciliatory words and sat down amid cheers. Blythe was faced with the choice of proceeding with the evening's set program, already in disarray, or honoring the American rule that nobody ever speaks after the president. He elected to abandon form altogether. Once, as a boy, he had driven 29 miles in a springless wagon to hear Fire Alarm Joe orate. He had an idea that Foraker might respond, if asked to do so, with the right combination of wit and suddenness. "The hour for bloody sarcasm having arrived," Blythe announced, "I take the liberty of calling upon Senator Foraker for some remarks." Foraker stood up, stark white in the face. He said that he was embarrassed at having to follow the president, but Roosevelt having so clearly singled him out by word and gesture, he would respond. The sarcasm most people were waiting for did not materialize at once, neither did the next course. Foraker spoke at length in defense of his own hands-off attitude to corporate control, earning napkin waves of approval from Millionaire's Row. Then at last he mentioned the word Brownsville and proceeded to justify his nickname. Never before, at the gridiron or anywhere else, had a president been challenged before an audience. Foraker was an unusually handsome man, more than 6 feet tall, and his unsmiling demeanor and effortless command of language made everything he said sound oracular. Napkins fluttered elsewhere in the room as he observed, in the words of the 14th Amendment, that all persons looked alike to him, black or white, male or female, old or young. He noted that the president had said earlier, in reference to big businessmen, that no man was either so high or so low that he would not give him the equal protection of the law if innocent of offense against the law. If so, where was equal protection for the innocents of Brownsville? Roosevelt had himself admitted that many absolutely innocent soldiers had been branded as criminals in his discharge order. First Sergeant Mingo Sanders, with 26 years of service and a record of bravery in battle, was left dependent and disgraced when he was nearing the time when he would have a right to retire on pay, without honor, even though Foraker knew, and had reason to believe Roosevelt knew, that he was as innocent of any offense against the law of any kind whatever as the president himself. Roosevelt half rose from his seat. Blythe had to restrain him, saying that he would have a chance for rebuttal after the senator finished. Foraker proceeded to squander his great moment, going on so long that Roosevelt again tried to interrupt and was again held back. Foraker grew maudlin. There had been a time, as the president well knew, when I loved him as though one of my own family. He still had an affectionate regard for him, and had, for the most part, cordially supported all the measures of his administration. At last he sat down. Such a hubbub ensued, with members crowding to congratulate him, that Blythe's gavel was unable to restore calm. Then Foraker heard a familiar, high-pitched voice, and saw the president standing, appealing to be heard. The noise subsided to a buzz that continued throughout Roosevelt's rebuttal. It muted what was, to attentive listeners, an exquisitely lethal moment when he suggested that Foraker's defense of the Brownsville rioters was consistent with the senator's enthusiastic backing, some years before, of a convicted double murderer for a United States Marshal. It was now nearly midnight, and 266 uneaten dinners had coagulated in the Willard kitchen. The buzz of conversation continued, but an air of unresolved disharmony hung over the tables. Uncle Joe Cannon got up in an attempt to clear it. If the floor of this great hall should suddenly cave in, and all the people here be precipitated to the cellar, it would not deter the progress of the United States. There was little applause. Roosevelt sat fiddling with a fork until Blythe called for a concluding song, then declared the 22nd annual dinner of the gridiron adjourned. Whatever shaky reputation for confidentiality the club had managed to preserve after Roosevelt's Man with the Muckrake speech was demolished by the Roosevelt-Foraker clash. A detailed account with exit interviews was published in the Washington Post. The scandal was immense, the political consequences immediate. Roosevelt jeered at Winthrop Murray Crane's concern that the alienated Foraker would cause a split in the Republican Party big enough to elect a Democrat in 1908. "I call that a splinter," he said. Far from aggravating the party's inner tensions, he felt that he had moved at just the right time to prevent a split. Fate had conspired to put in his way a provocative cartoon caption, a row of financiers, and Foraker himself, the man most likely to get Wall Street's vote in 1908 if something lethal was not done to him soon, in front of the most power-packed audience Washington could muster. It had been a rhetorical opportunity irresistible even to a president who loved to eat. His lecture to the plutocrats and segue to an attack on Foraker had branded the senator as an apologist for wealth, if only by association. Conversely, by his reiteration of the War Department's case against the 25th Infantry, he had shown himself to be someone who stuck to moral principles. Distasteful though the spectacle of a president and senator squabbling had been to some guests, Roosevelt's favorite audience, a mythical, grizzled farmer reading a newspaper at fireside, would probably see a confrontation of right versus wrong, or executive versus legislative, or authority versus anarchy, or whatever other antitheses suggested themselves. Closer to home, political professionals saw an effective blow in favor of Taft against Foraker for the nomination in 1908. The secretary, who had accompanied Roosevelt to the gridiron dinner, was actually a reluctant party to the Brownsville discharges. He had been on vacation at the time of the incident, and the first prosecutorial steps had been taken in Oyster Bay. Taft's subsequent attempt to suspend the discharges and get a rehearing of the evidence against the soldiers had been prompted by an emotional appeal on their behalf from the president of the National Association of Colored Women. Most recently, he had annoyingly drawn Roosevelt's attention to a conflict in the testimony of the eyewitnesses who saw black soldiers kill Frank Natus, and suggested that the Senate be informed. These scruples were, however, kept confidential, so Taft had come away from the new Willard looking more than ever a loyal cabinet officer unbeholden to Wall Street, who just happened to hail from the same state as Senator Foraker. By the time the Senate Committee on Military Affairs began its investigation,